Well, thanks so much, everybody, for coming. Grab a seat if you need to. My name is Jeremy Pataki. I'm a board member at the 49 Alaska Writing Center. We're really excited about this new series that tonight is the inauguration of. It's a series called Cross Currents, as Andromeda mentioned. And Cross Currents will be a series of live, onstage, moderated discussions between authors before a live audience. We know all of you are going to buy and read the great books by these three. Tonight's a chance to get beyond the books themselves and have a discussion about some of the ideas found there, and to foster a dialogue tonight and that hopefully will continue beyond tonight. Halfway through the discussion, we're actually going to collect some written questions and pass them to our moderator, Charles Woolforth. So if you haven't already grabbed a little note card and a pencil, and if you'd like one, raise your hand, and we'll get those to you in case you end up with a question you'd like to ask. And 30 minutes or so in, we'll pass those to the middle and collect them and possibly include them in the conversation. Also, afterward, the authors will be available to sign books, which are for sale here, thanks to the UAA bookstore. And we also, as you've seen, have some tables with good information from Alaska Center for the Environment and the 49 Alaska Writing Center. I'll introduce Charles, our moderator, and turn it over to him to introduce our other authors, Nancy Lord and Mary Beth Holloman, and get it rolling. Not that any of them need an introduction, but Charles Woolforth is a lifelong Alaskan, and he writes books about Alaska. He lives here in Anchorage in the winter and spends summers at a remote site, only accessible by boat in Kachemak Bay. His most recent book is called The Fate of Nature, Rediscovering Our Ability Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. It's a great read. I highly recommend it. And he's also one host of KSKA's program, Hometown Alaska. So, welcome you three. Thank you so much for being here. We're very excited to have you, and I'll turn it over to Charles.
Thanks, Jeremy and Andromeda, and thanks everybody for being here. It's a terrific turnout and a good sign, I think, for this series of talks that you're planning to have, which is a terrific contribution to the Anchorage scene and really exciting thing to be doing. Two writers on stage with me, and they're each going to do a short reading, and then we're going to have a conversation. I thought I'd just go ahead and introduce both of them to you now. Nancy Lord is... we're just trying to figure out how long we've known each other, about 25 years from back when I was a Homer News newspaper and newspaper writer, and she was saving the environment in Homer, and she's still at it, apparently without success, but she's still trying. She was Alaska's writer laureate for the last 2 years, 2008 through 2010. She's the author of 8 books, 3 fiction and 5 nonfiction. She's the chair of the Alaska Conservation Foundation, and she represents Cook Inlet Keeper on the Beluga Task Force and has been involved in many, many other groups and has made a great contribution over the years. And our other author is Mary Beth Holloman. Haven't known quite as long, but have known for a few years. And I wanted to hold up Nancy's book, which I've had a chance to read most of in the last couple of weeks, and it is fascinating and kind of a departure for her. Which we'll be talking about. It's called Early Warming, Crisis and Response in the Climate-Changed North. It's just come out this month, and it's from Counterpoint, and we'll hear a lot more about it. So Mary Beth is also a well-known writer. She's taught writing workshops. She's got a workshop that she's doing for 49 writers in April called Beginnings. Besides the book she'll primarily be talking about this evening, which is The Heart of the Sound, came out several years ago from University of Nebraska Press. I read it, and it was really helpful to me when I was writing my book, The Fate of Nature, It's now come out in paperback, and it's an excellent read and a good opportunity for people to discover a book that they should have discovered the first time around. And she's also the editor of Cross Currents North, Alaskans on the Environment, which is an anthology, and both of those in Nancy's book are for sale this evening. And there's a lot more that I could say about each of these writers, but I think that hearing their own words is probably a better introduction. And so I'd like to ask Mary Beth to go ahead and take the microphone and do a short reading from her book. However you like to do it.
How's that? There we go. Okay. All right. So I'll be reading briefly from The Heart of the Sound. And the section I'm reading is about two-thirds into the book, 8 years after the spill. And it's a chapter on restoration. I'm out in the Southwestern Sound on some lands that were recently, conservation easements were recently placed on them at this time. And that was what they used some of the oil spill natural resource settlement funds for. And this is a Chiniga Island that I'm on. And the reason I'm reading this section, just two things I want to say. One is that with the BP Gulf of Mexico spill, which we've been hearing so much about, we know once the oil's in the water, it's pretty much all over. So what can you do? And one of the things that we were able to do here is to protect habitat. And, you know, that's something they can look at, the wetlands and also marine reserves. And also, since we'll be talking mostly about climate change tonight, I spoke about this on the radio and got the name a little wrong. Thomas Lovejoy was here in Anchorage a few months ago and said that plants can save us in terms of climate change. He said that there have been a couple other times in the planet's history where carbon emissions were high, were spiking, and they dropped. The first time was the origin of land plants, and the second time was the origin of flowering plants on land. So, again, if we can allow forests to be preserved, then that's one way that we can help mitigate climate change. Okay. Habitat protection ultimately restored what we most needed to restore, our relationship with the place, not through management, not through abstinence. Restoring our right relationship with Prince William Sound required learning, or remembering, a way to be in the natural world that didn't desecrate or overrun, but that maintained and respected. This is the way of attentive love, action based on the love that comes from being aware of what the place and its inhabitants need and desire. Attentive love requires an ethic of humility. It requires faith in ourselves. Rejecting excessive control, it reveres the process of life. At times, the way of attentive love is inaction. Sometimes it's best to do nothing. Examples abound. The genetic scientist Barbara McClintock said she listened to the corn. Biologist Jane Goodall let herself be guided by the chimpanzees. As the plane took off from Chiniga, and my view of the newly protected lands expanded and then grew smaller, I thought about some friends who had spent years observing sea otters in the Sound. How would saving the forest help the sea otters recover from the oil spill, I had asked them. In winter, they'd told me, when all the researchers had broken camp and gone home, when the cleanup equipment was stored in a warehouse, when the villagers were in their homes in Chiniga Bay and Tetitlik eating dried salmon, the reversing waterfalls at Ewan Bay was rife with life. Lined with a bed of mussels more than a foot deep, the lagoon at low tide drew in sea otters. Just weaned pups feasted on mussels in shallow, still waters, while their mothers hauled out and rested on the boulders by the waterfall. River otters, ermine, and other forest creatures sometimes came down from the forest. It was an oasis for the sea otters, especially the pups, from wild winter storms. It was a place of commingling, forest and sea life entwined. In the longest season, winter, the place was left to itself, there in the still lagoon, by the waterfall, which continued to flow back and forth with every tide. Thanks.
Thank you. So that was, yes, good. That was Mary Beth Holloman's book, The Heart of the Sound, An Alaskan Paradise Found and Nearly Lost, which, as I should have introduced, is a lot about Prince William Sound and the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And now I'd like to ask Nancy Lohr to read from her new book, Early Warming, Crisis and Response in the Climate Change North.
Thank you. My book is... is my mic on? Okay. Okay. My book is... mostly telling stories from different places in the North, Alaska and part of the Canadian Northwest. But I'm going to read a little from the introduction that kind of just sets the scene rather than any of the parts of those stories. So this is from the beginning of the book. Among the visuals that accompany reports and projections of global warming, there's typically a map of the world that uses color to indicate temperature change. Blue stands for cooler than the mean, for a given time period, yellow and orange for hotter. The reddest bands circle the high northern latitudes, and at least on the NASA map showing trends since 1955, the hottest spot of all lies like congealed blood over Alaska and the Canadian Northwest. This is where I live, and where, like others from the north, I'm acutely aware of environmental change that has killed most of the spruce trees in my part of Alaska, eroded shorelines, and shifted our fisheries into different species and ranges. Globally, surface air temperatures have increased by a bit more than 1 degree Fahrenheit in the last 100 years, a measly 1 degree, and yet already the climate disruption that's resulted from that warming has been profound. Climate, it helps to remember, is the pattern of weather, encompassing averages, extremes, timing, and spatial distributions of temperatures, precipitation, and events like blizzards and tornadoes. Climate change refers to altered patterns. A small change of global average temperature, an index or indicator of the state of the global climate, can mean large changes in the patterns. In Alaska and other parts of the North, average temperatures have increased rapidly and dramatically. Just in the last 50 years, Alaska temperatures averaged across the state and through the year have risen by 3.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Winter temperatures have risen more sharply by an average of 6.3 degrees. Temperature increases have varied by community. Mine, Homer, Alaska, has seen its year-round temperature increase by 3.1 degrees and its winter snows turn to rain. In February of 2010, even the slush melted away. Moose knelt in our yards to eat green grass, and my neighbors and I went about without jackets or hats in sunny warmth as temperatures shot toward 50. Then in March, a blizzard dumped 4 feet of snow. Temperatures dropped to zero, and schools were closed for the first time in decades. Polar amplification, the science phrase for the tendency of temperature change to increase with latitude, depends on a number of factors, some of which are not yet well understood. The main process at work is the ice albedo positive feedback, which simply means that when ice and snow melt, the darker land and water surfaces absorb more solar heat, causing more ice and snow to melt. More open water allows for strong heat transfers from the ocean to the atmosphere. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change expects that climate change in the Arctic will be among the largest and most rapid on Earth, with wide-ranging physical, ecological, sociological, and economic effects. Its fourth assessment in 2007 noted that the polar regions are, quote, extremely vulnerable to current and projected climate change, of considerable geopolitical and economic importance, and are, again, quote, the regions with the greatest potential to affect global climate and thus human populations and biodiversity. In other words, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. The polar regions function as the cooling system for our planet. As the climate and environment of the North change, so will the climate and ocean systems that regulate the entire world. The Kansas farmer and Florida vacationer don't need to care about desperately swimming polar bears or Inupiat hunters falling through ice to be concerned about what's happening at the top of the world. Thanks.
Well, I think a good starting point for our discussion is to talk about, since we're here to talk about both the environment and talk about writing, is the starting point for these projects. And whenever we write, we have to kind of, it's an act of communication, so we have to think about the audience and what we're trying to accomplish. And I'm wondering, from your book, Mary Beth, in many parts it seems very, very personal, and it's your response to the place that you're in and the events that are happening there. What brought about the decision to communicate that or make that public in a book?
Well, I think that by sharing our stories, we relate to one another and we learn to love a place and understand what's happened to it. And I, you know, I'm thinking maybe I'll just tell a story and answer that. I had a piece about 10 years after the spill in Orion magazine, and it became a chapter in the book. And they had a letter to the editor, to Orion magazine, from a guy in Durham, North Carolina, near where I spent part of my life. And he said, you know, I picked it up and I thought, damn, you know, another article about the oil spill. I'm tired of hearing about the oil spill. I don't want to read this. But he read it, and then he said he realized that, yeah, it was about the oil spill, but it was really about what happens to a place you love when something happens to it, and what do, and how do you feel? And he related it to the Eno River that he is working to help protect and restore. And so I think that's why it's good for us to tell our personal stories, because other people can, it gives windows to other people to understand and relate to their own.
Mm-hmm. Do you, when you're writing, do you have someone that you picture in your mind's eye that you're writing to? Or I know a lot of, that's something that a lot of writing teachers tell you to do, is to think about who your audience is. And I'm just curious as to whether you are you thinking about a guy in Durham reading the Orion magazine, or who are you thinking about?
You know, I don't. I have to say I don't really think about audience when I'm doing my first draft of a piece at all. I think about what it is I want to say and how to say it most effectively. And so when I was writing about the oil spill in Prince William Sound, one of my driving forces was to give voice to this place. And how can I do that? You know, how can I give voice to this place? How can I show that the love of a place is like the love of a person, and that when something happens to a place, it's like when something happens to a beloved person? And that, mm-hmm. you know, that was my intention. And so I think I thought more about that than audience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely what I got from the book. And sometimes when something of that magnitude happens in your life and in your world, you're in a sense compelled to write about it. It's so big there's nothing else you can write about. Is that sort of the experience you had, or was it more considered that this is the topic that I'm going to focus on?
Oh, no, it was compelled. I had an entirely different project in mind, and then the oil spill happened, and, you know, that just went out the window. And it was the only thing I could think to write about.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take before you sort of reached a completion stage and you were ready to move on to something else? if that's occurred.
Way too long. Well, first I was writing short pieces. You know, I wrote a piece for NPR. I wrote an essay here and there, an article. And then I started thinking about it as a narrative, as a book. So it was a very long process. And one of the reasons it was a long process is because I didn't know how to end the book. You know, how do you end something that doesn't end? so the book goes through, you know, the first 10 years after the spill.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Nancy, in your work, I've read all of your books, obviously, but one book that I particularly liked, Fish Camp, is very much a closely considered look at a particular place and a particular people, a particular time, and in some ways is more similar to the Heart of the Sound than it is to your book Early Warming, which is taking a broader look and a more journalistic look, more scientific, sort of more the objective facts. And I was wondering what brought you to this topic and to approach it in this way?
To tell the truth, I didn't really want to write this book. it was actually my agent who badgered me, actually, for several years, saying, you are the person who lives there, you must tell this story. And I kept thinking what story can I tell that hasn't already been told, you know, better by someone else? And for example, your book, The Whale and the Supercomputer, I thought really beautifully told. I mean, I'm not trying to flatter you on purpose here, but it really told how, you know, what was happening in Alaska. And so I was thinking, you know, what could I do? But then I figured it out, and what I attempted to do in this book was to sort of go beyond the fact that climate change is happening in Alaska and try to tell stories of how people are coping and adapting. And I was particularly interested in, as you said, not my own experience so much, but the experience of others, particularly people in the Arctic and in Native cultures that have a long familiarity with the environment, long intimate relationship with the environment, and I think have a lot that we can learn from in being resilient and adaptive and innovative in dealing with climate change. So so I thought I could help tell those stories. Mm-hmm. So yes, it's more journalistic in that sense. Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me you're really writing for someone who maybe knows something about it. Obviously, they're not. Everyone knows something about climate change, but they're not necessarily in Alaska, and they don't necessarily know the places or the characters or the issues. And you're trying to bring them from a place where they are pretty far from this place and bring them into it. And I'm wondering what the literary challenges of that are. How do you think about where the person is coming from that for whom you're writing and bring them to where you want to get them?
Mm. I guess in contrast to Mary Beth, I was thinking of audience, and I was thinking of, you know, not Alaskans specifically, but people in the lower 48 who are not as familiar as we are with what's happening here. And I thought that the way to get them into the factual story was through individual and community stories. So, I mean, I would agree, it's really all about the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
It's about telling stories to draw people into learning about other people's interesting lives and scenes and such, you know, this creative part of this writing where you try to create scenes and things are happening and it's not just a bunch of dry facts.
Right. Do you have a something in mind what you want the reader to do after they finish reading the book? I mean, obviously, the book is written for a reason. It's not simply to lay out a situation. We've got to do something about it. How do you where are you hoping they end up?
My purpose really was in telling these stories to hopefully convince people that we really need to address the problem at the root, that we really need to not put so much carbon dioxide in the air. We need to control our emissions. I wanted them to see that it's not easy trying to adapt and change, and that it's going to be very, very difficult. It's very painful for people going through it now, and it's going to be hard for them too, and that rather than do nothing, it would be better to do something now. Mm-hmm. To address the problem.
It seems to me on this, a lot of environmental issues, but especially on climate change, there's this willingness to jump to despair and think, well, it's too big, there's nothing we can do about it, it's a terrible thing, but it's either sort of denial, it's not happening at all, or it's so bad that it's hopeless. And finding that middle ground is tough because you want to emphasize how bad the problem is without driving people to the point of just giving up. And I'm wondering how you personally feel about it, living in a place which is changing in these permanent ways and sort of the emotional toll that takes. How do you feel? Do you think that we're going to solve this problem? And do you have to lie a little bit, you know, in order to get people to still, you know, want to act?
I tend to be pretty cynical, I guess, about it. I don't think we're going to solve it. I think we're going to see a lot of human suffering and a lot of extinctions and a very different world that we're going to be living in quite shortly. But I don't think that that's reason to throw up our hands and not do anything. I did have, in the course of writing this book, I've read a lot of books about climate change, and I noticed that there seemed to be sort of a pattern in them where it would be sort of, you know, this is a terrible situation, and then the last chapter would be about hope. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and kind of encouraging people to go, you know, change their light bulbs and do these things, and it all kind of seemed a little too facile mm-hmm. to me and forced, and so I said I wasn't going to do that. Mm-hmm. So there's a sentence right near the end where I say something like, I'm not hopeful, but I cannot be without hope, or something, mm-hmm. something to that effect. And then I kind of pass it off to the next generation.
Can I be without hope because the editor won't let me?
but you're absolutely right. I mean, people don't really want to read a story that's just all depressing.
Right.
I mean, there's got to be, you know, something a little more. Mm-hmm. I don't know if hopeful is the right word, but
right.
And
well,
that's a huge challenge, I think, for environmental writing in general, is how. How to be honest and not, you know, do a quick Hollywood ending and mm-hmm. and, you know, still get people to read through it, you know. And I think that's why, you know, character development, like the way Nancy's book tells stories, and you start caring about the people and the communities, then you want to keep reading and you want to keep thinking and doing something about it. So but I think that's a huge task for environmental writing in general.
And I wanted to direct that question to you, too, because the Heart of the Sound, the subtitle is An Alaskan Paradise Found and Nearly Lost. Uh-huh. And there is a little bit of a redemptive quality in the end of the book. But on the other hand, there's also, I would say, the main thrust of the book is about grief and grieving. And I don't think you sugarcoat that at all. You know, obviously. But was there a sense that you felt compelled to find a redemptive narrative line you could insert in the book, or was that a natural part of the material?
Yeah, that was a big struggle. I think that's what I meant by it was hard to end it. Mm-hmm. What I do in the end is more about, it's about how to live, you know, what did Aldo Leopold say, you know, when you're an environmentalist, you live in a world of wounds. And so how do you do that? How do you keep your eyes open to the world of wounds, you know, and keep living and keep getting up every day? And I think that finding that balance is something that is what I'm talking about in the end there. That Buddhist story about the master's cup that's broken, and he tells the man who breaks his cup, that's okay, I've always drunk from that cup as if it was broken. That idea that we never know what's going to happen, and to be aware and thankful for what we have and keep working to make the world a better place.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're... I want to remind the audience that your questions are welcome, and please, I think there's someone going to be going around picking them up, and they'll hand them forward, and we'll do as many as we can. I'm interested in when you talk about this personal relationship with a place, and I know from both of your work that that's a very real thing. I guess I'm interested in if you agree with the statement that that's why you can't run away from the topic. In other words, it'd be easier to write about something else, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And it would certainly be easier to sell manuscripts about something else.
Yeah.
It would be easier to write happy stories about something else, but that's what you're stuck with. And I guess I was going to ask each of you, how did you get stuck with that? How did that relationship take place? And Mayor Beth, since it's in a central part of your book, maybe you could talk about that.
Well, I think it, you know, it hits us at a young age. His name is Frederick Buechner. He's an American writer, and he said that our calling is at the intersection of our great gladness and the world's great need. And my great gladness from a very young age were books and the natural world. It was, that was just, that was my home, and that's where I felt most myself. And so when I was, I remember the first Earth Day, and that's when I realized that the planet might need me too. And, I think that was when it started. And then it was a matter of figuring out what I could do. So I did, after college, I did some work in government for the North Carolina Energy Institute back during our first energy crisis, and realized that the written word had such power over me. You know, I know how I felt after I read The Monkey Wrench Gang, for example, and so I realized that perhaps writing was a better way for me to contribute.
Mm-hmm. Nancy, can you answer that? You've got more time to think about it, so you're
yes.
the lucky one.
I have a less good answer.
All right.
I think we're just sort of called to write certain things, and I just try to follow whatever I'm thinking about. I mean, the questions that come to me, I want to sort of write my way into some kind of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I did start writing really more as a fiction writer when I went to graduate school. I studied fiction writing and wrote a couple collections of short stories before I really started writing nonfiction. And I think for me it was a matter of honing my skills and getting comfortable with my own belief system. And writing fiction was easier earlier because I felt, you know, anyone can make up a story. You don't have to really have any special authority or knowledge. I don't think that's correct. I don't think the difference is that dramatic anymore, but that's what I thought at the time. The time came when I was writing Fish Camp, where I thought, well, yeah, this is some place that I really know, and I am an authority on this, and I can write. This is my material, and anything I say is legitimate. And it's just expanded outward from there, from my very particular place to a little broader world.
Uh-huh. I'm interested in how you relate your writing and your activism. If writing, has the activism invaded your writing, or did you always see a writing as a political act, Nancy?
It's become more intensified that way, I think. I mean, I think I was like Mary Beth. I was always a political activist going back to, you know, probably high school and certainly college. I have been and still am involved in conservation causes, but I guess I feel at this point I'm sort of, you know, a good enough writer that's where I should be, what I should be doing, mm-hmm. rather than more overt political actions. I should be using those skills to try to influence people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I want to go to these questions, but I also wanted to ask, in terms of writing and the political act of writing, can you, and I guess it's a good question for you, Mary Beth, because of the way your book is structured it with this personal material. Can you approach it in terms of thinking of the political act that you want the reader, the political effect you want to have, or does it have to just sort of basically come out of your heart, and if it motivates them in the right direction, that's good?
Well, you know the saying, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
If you start a piece, and I have written pieces like this that I've started, and I know exactly what I want to convince the reader of. Well, you know, it's fun to write those rants, but I don't really think they're very effective for the most part. So I have to write from a place of not knowing where I'm heading and not really knowing I have some vague idea of what I want to say, but if I'm too pointed, if I know too much in advance about what I want to say, it's flat.
Right. Nancy, this is a good question for your in relation to your new book, because you spend a lot of time in different cultures and looking at how they are being affected or relating to climate change and the way it's changing their environments. The questioner asks, when writing about native issues, how do you handle cultural appropriation? In other words, how do you avoid, I guess, taking away something that doesn't belong to you while doing what you need to do as a writer?
Good. Yeah, very good question. I try to be sensitive to that, and in selecting where I went, I tried to set things up ahead of time so that I was invited and welcome, and I had contacts with people there who would be comfortable talking with me and introducing me to other people. And sometimes you know this as a journalist too. You sort of edit yourself. You're selective about what you use, what you say, how you portray people. I always sort of position myself as thinking I'm a guest in the home of these people, and I need to behave, appropriately. So I wouldn't want to, embarrass people, or certainly didn't want to misrepresent things. And I generally, as much as I could, often try to check things with people too after they're written before they're published. So, I'm reporting. I don't feel like I'm taking people's material and doing something with it that's, using it in an inappropriate way. Mm-hmm. I'm really trying to assist them to tell their stories. But it's a very sensitive. Very sensitive thing. I'm sure you had that same experience when you're doing the whale on the supercomputer and working with the people up in Barrow and so on. Yeah.
Well, when I think any writer who's working in Alaska Native communities, you realize that what you're told is more than what you would be told in the dominant society, because people aren't as used to talking to reporters, and so you kind of have to set up a wall to keep material that they, when they become too intimate, from getting into the work. For fear that you're going to, break, confidence with, so you could do this cross-cultural thing, and I've certainly found that. I don't know, Mary Beth, have you run into that sort of issue when you're working in Alaska Native communities, where these different rules apply, and you suddenly find yourself in a much more intimate situation than you ever would with a source in the dominant society, and figure out how to deal with that?
Yeah, I think that's true. You just have to be aware of those cultural differences, and there's a lot of differences in terms of communication. I remember when I first started teaching at UAA, I was teaching composition courses, and they gave us a seminar about how Alaska Native students communicate in class, and even body language and things like that. That it is very different, and to be aware of that and respectful of that. So. I think that is real important, and I do, if I write something where I'm including other people and their stories, I do try, as like Nancy said, to check with them and make sure that it's accurate and that it's okay with them.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I do that myself, and then I always run into particular situations where. A source will want to edit things which I represent my opinion, or represent something which I think is true about them, but they may not want to have be seen by the world. What do you feel is the ethic of that? Do you have a responsibility to the reader to portray that person in a way that even if that source might not want to be portrayed that way? Nancy, do you want to?
Yeah, well, I think it's very case by case. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It would be hard to generalize.
Yeah, it's a negotiation process.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, this questioner asks, and this is a good question for both authors, when you take on such a broad subject as an oil spill or climate change, how do you decide what to include? How do you narrow it down to make it accessible without reducing the scope? In the case of the oil spill, your narrowing is through a personal vision, isn't it? It's not like you have to go out and make a checklist of things you want to cover. That's for somebody else.
Right, yeah. I mean, I'm relating my experiences so that helped me a lot. Mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to tell other people's stories very much.
But you didn't know an awful lot about the oil spill. Were you editing it all, some of that outside knowledge, to keep it out and just keep your vision narrow and focused?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. I had to. It would have gone all different ways.
Nancy, how did you choose the stories that you were going to tell and the places you were going to go?
Well, I didn't try to address climate change as a big subject, but I only got sort of fed in the necessary science and politics and other things that needed to be said along the way, just as necessary, and tried to focus on what I was seeing and hearing from people. But it's true. Sometimes I would write kind of massive amounts and get caught up in it, and then I would know that it was too much of a mind dump or whatever you want to call it, and I would take a number of pages and say, okay, I need to say this in one page, and just refocus and summarize.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're faced with the issue of presenting scientific fact, and then the characters who are dealing with that set of that situation and keeping the reader with you while you go through the science. Are you kind of aware of that the reader wants to get to the characters, but you've got to give them the science to get them there and understand what's happening?
Yeah, I was very aware of sort of, I guess, balancing really three things and not going too far away from the story. I mean, sort of the narrative story I wanted to be what was driving it, so that what people were doing and saying and thinking and the activity thing, and then I would try to feed in the necessary science and other aspects into that, and then the third part was sort of reflection, where I would kind of step back and say, this is what I was thinking about, and this is how I, what meaning I drew from what I had just experienced, but not to dwell there too long, and then get back to the story.
This is a question I was thinking about as I was headed over here, and it was kind of spurred by some of the thoughts that you had emailed about how this kind of work fits into the canon of American literature. And it's, as I was thinking about it, that sort of the first truly American writers really were dealing with, if not environmental topics, and certainly nature and the way human beings fit into nature. Obviously, like Emerson and Thoreau, but then also Walt Whitman and Melville and even Mark Twain. And as an Alaskan and an visual arts, it was also true that American artistic styles only came about after artists started painting pictures of American scenes. For Alaskans, where it seems like it's like American squared, that Alaska is so vast, there are so few people here, and it's so grand, that in a sense it's really hard to think about what the heck else you could write about. And I think that's been a challenge in the visual arts too. It's like another picture of a mountain, mm-hmm. another picture of a river. What does this have to do with us? It's a sort of open-ended discussion topic. I don't want to force a question on you, but how do you see yourself and sort of this kind of writing we're talking about fitting into sort of the American literature? And is that an issue? Is that a problem for Alaskan writers to figure out how you avoid being overwhelmed by the subject?
Yeah. I think it is hard for a writer in Alaska to not end up having nature be a character in their work. It's just hard. And so I don't think we should. I think we should just allow it. But in terms of how it fits into literature in general, pretty much what you said, that it's always been a part of American literature. And actually, Thoreau and Muir and those guys actually helped create the environmental movement, sort of unwittingly, but just because their writing gave the idea that there was this need to protect and preserve and conserve the natural world. And so nature writing or environmental writing has sort of a unique place in environmental literature in that way. But I think it also just seamlessly feeds into all the canons and the canon as a whole. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a vague answer, but
do you want to add anything to that, Nancy?
I think in recent years there's been an interesting movement from nature writing to what's sometimes called the new nature writing, sort of like the shift from journalism to the new journalism. Mm-hmm. People are always inventing new forms of what's usually not really all that new. But in any writing, I think our sort of mantra is always, Ezra Pound's thing about make it make it new, always trying to make it new. And the interesting shift has been, you know, from the old kind of more standard nature writing, which was a lot about appreciating nature and so on, to this more kind of environmental type of writing that's more activism oriented. Not that we didn't have that before. I mean, Rachel Carson and people like that. But also people who write with a lot of humor and that involve you know, different scales of nature. I mean, urban nature and you know, nature's not so narrowly defined anymore. It's a big tent.
Is it, you know, another thing I've thought about when thinking about that broad span of literature is that there's an awful lot of it that is about loss and about the conflicts in this, you know, in this kind of writing tend to be about a threat or a loss and sort of a grief over a loss or a loss that's occurring or that's feared to occur. And that's certainly true in the both of these books. Is that kind of an essential factor of being someone who writes about this topic in this time? Are we sort of trapped in that? And is that a kind of in our culture, some topics of that seriousness are really discouraged? I mean, are we in a tiny niche, or can we write about these things for a broad society? And is there interest in that?
Well, I think that goes back to that, you know, the million-dollar question: how do we tell these stories truthfully and get more than the choir to read them?
Mm-hmm.
I think that is possible. I would really like to write a happy story. I really meant to after this one. Wanted to, and so I wrote some poems that were happy. But I think that just any good story has to have conflict. I mean, that's just part of it. Otherwise, it's not really compelling. So maybe that's where our conflict is. That's our source of conflict, is that sense of loss.
Did you want to weigh in on that one?
I'll pass on.
All right. Well, I mean, the other is, cultural thing that's happened is the culture is sort of highly polarized, and you know, there's a great number of people out there. We don't know exactly how many who think that a book like yours is just, Nancy, is about climate change is pure fantasy. Is there a way to engage that part of the cultural universe, or are we sort of just need to work with what people who are listening? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, that is the key question, I think. I think as writers, we want to influence people to see the world the way we see it. I guess my answer again is, you know, telling a good story and hopefully drawing people in who might be willing to hear the story and then learn something from it that might change the way they see the world. It's a challenge, and I don't know. I mean, there are only so many people who read, and there are only so many people who read sort of serious, you know, literary nonfiction, and I don't know how you get through to everyone else.
Right. Well, what are the? I mean, there's. You're writing about something that is very essentially new, though. I mean, there is news in the fact that places are thawing that have not thawed in human history, and that these natural things are changing. And I guess I'm interested in what you thought were the most surprising or the most significant things you found in your research about the changes that are happening in Alaska.
Oh, gosh, I haven't thought enough about that. Probably the most surprising when I was doing my research was some of the information about methane in the permafrost and under this frozen seabed and under lakes and so on, and the potential for that to be very seriously disruptive.
Could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas, and there's a lot that seems to be being released as the permafrost thaws, and even the parts of the frozen seabed. And there's actually one of the scientists in Fairbanks has been doing really amazing work in that area. She's a real leader in it. But the other piece that most interests me is the whole ocean piece. What's happening with the oceans as they're warming, and also the ocean acidification as the chemistry is being changed with the additional carbon dioxide.
That's probably one that a lot. I don't know if people would probably need that one explained too. Ocean acidification.
Yeah, I think most Alaskans are hearing quite a bit about it and familiar, but it's still pretty new to people outside. But a third of the carbon dioxide that goes into the air from anthropogenic sources, human caused, is being absorbed into the ocean. We used to think that was great because it was buffering climate change, but now we call it the evil twin, or the other CO2 problem. The chemistry's changing, and the ocean waters are actually becoming corrosive to the critters that have shells, including some of the plankton that are at the bottom of the food chain. So we're potentially going to be seeing very big changes. And again, it's Alaskans who are, you know, Jeremy Mathis up at UAF and others on his team are doing this really, front lines research on these subjects. So Alaska's really, leading in the science
and in the impact, in other words, the people who are suffering the most,
yeah.
and yet sort of in the political arena, fighting the hardest to avoid doing anything about it in some sense. And do you have any thoughts about why we're in that very strange position politically? I mean, let her rip.
Well, I would just say, political leaders usually don't lead, they follow, and we need to do a lot more to be activists and convince them that they need to follow the public on this. Apparently they think, at least right now, that they are, observing the will of the people who elected them. But I mentioned actually, Representative Don Young at least three times in my book in not very favorable ways. He really truly is one of the worst in terms of calling global warming a myth and really turning a blind eye to the needs of Alaskans.
I think also in terms of our state politics, just generally that we. Our politicians tend to look at short-term problems and solutions, so the housing market, the banking crisis, but climate change, what we need are long-term solutions, and it's a long-term problem. And so I think it's that short-term versus long-term thinking that we need to deal with somehow in terms of how politicians deal with issues, so they're not just thinking about the next election.
Well, and the oil pollution issue as well. We had the oil spill, Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound, and then we go 20 years later and we have an oil blowout in the Gulf of Alaska, and the outcome, Gulf of Mexico, and the outcome seems so similar to a lot of people. I was wondering, Mary Beth, if you would address your feelings when that took place and sort of your observations about the similarities between the two events.
Yeah, it was like a 21-year echo. It really was, in terms of what was happening and in terms of things that people would say there, what fishermen would say and native elders. The quotes could have been pulled straight from our oil spill. And also the other thing that really struck me is that it seems like we didn't learn anything from the spill here. And the only ones that learned anything were the oil companies. They learned how to lie about how much oil was coming out and how to keep reporters from going to places where there were oiled birds and to just mask the situation. That their PR campaign seemed a whole lot better than when ours happened. But other than that, it seemed like we hadn't learned a thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was sad and I was angry and I, thought, what can I tell people there? And I wrote an op-ed that appeared in some papers there and said, you got to bear witness. You got to tell your stories, and you have to bear witness. And let this be yet another cautionary tale so that we can prevent this from happening in other places and other times.
Well, that seems like a really good spot to end. I want to thank both of you. It's been a really interesting conversation. Yeah. Nancy Lord, Mary Beth Holloman will be here afterwards signing books and answering individual questions. And thank you all for coming.